Thank you. So, thank you, both you and Victor, for the invitation to come here and spend a week with the colony, as I explained to people who ask where I'm going. Say, I'm going to visit the colony. And then they say, what do you mean a colony? Well, there's all these theoretical physicists in kind of a colony, and you can visit, and you talk to them. And so the purpose of my talk today is to try not really to tell you about things we've done and are not thinking about anymore because we published, but more about things that we're in the process of doing or thinking about doing and haven't developed that much. So because of that, most of this talk is something I haven't prepared before, so I worked hard for today. But also you'll see there's a kind of disjointness. It's kind of a pile of ideas, and I hope I can explain everything clearly. Before doing so, I have to point out that we're in Cone Hall, and we're very proud that Walter Cone got a bachelor's and a master's degree at the University of Toronto in 1945 and 46. He's one of our distinguished graduates, so happy to be here in Cone Hall. All right, so I'm going to tell you about a theoretical idea about species-selective optical lattices. Yeah,
Chair. Sorry, continue, microphone.
Oh, yeah, sure. All right. Then I'm going to tell you about experimental work, achieving a Bose-Fermi mixture on a chip, and how we use that to make an RF-dressed double well trap. And then what we're trying to do with that is look for number squeezing directly. And if this isn't enough, I have a few more topics that we can talk about if you're interested. So the people in the lab right now is one postdoc and five graduate students. And let me highlight especially Dr. Torsten Schum, who was with us last summer and set up our double well experiment. He's now an assistant professor at Vienna with Schmiedmeier. Jason McKeever arrived in the lab in February, and he's put a lot of new energy and thought into these splitting experiments. The lead graduate students are Marcus Extivore and Lindsay LeBlanc. Okay, so let me talk to you a little about species-selective optical lattices. This is kind of something that started like, wouldn't it be nice if for every species you had, you could independently do whatever you want with the trap? And so you could maybe make a lattice for one species, but nothing for the other species. You could maybe compress isothermally. So here's a well that both species are seeing. Here's a black dots and open dots. And if these black dots see this potential here, you can compress them and let them rethermalize with the white dots here, and then take them away, and so you can see that you've used a background reservoir to compress isothermally. But you can only do that if you can change one of these two potentials and not do anything to the other one. Okay, so what other kind of things would you be able to do if you had species-selective potentials? Fay was just mentioning yesterday that he's thinking of dressing vortices with a different species in order to image and manipulate them. And so you could maybe pull around one of these vortices if you had light that just pulled on one of the species. Another issue that you could address is overlap engineering. If you want to have a Bose-Fermi mixture, it's often the case that the Fermi energy is much higher than the chemical potential of the Bose condensate. So in an inhomogeneous trap, it means that the condensate's little in the middle and the Fermi cloud is huge. But if you could relax selectively the boson trap, then they would be well overlapped, which would facilitate mediated interactions or interesting mixture physics. So what kind of traps exist right now? Well, most experiments start with and maybe finish with a magnetic trap, which has spin selectivity. If you want to work with Feshbach resonances, you typically go to a far-off resonance trap. And there's very little species selectivity. So rubidium and potassium, for instance, the atoms we work with, would see pretty much the same trap. Onofrio and colleagues proposed in 2001 and 2002 a two-color trap, where you take something like a far-off resonance blue trap, and you counterbalance a far-off resonance red trap. And that tuning turns out to be a little different for two different species. And so you can use that to do something like I'm saying, where you have a different trap for each species. But none of these could actually create an optical lattice for one of the species and no lattice for the other.
I have a question here. So if you go to the power resonance trap, if I go between the fine structure, go to the point of zero, like in the spin-dependent lattices?
Yes, that's what I'm going to talk about.
But that's an answer here, right?
So that's one of the answers, one of the two ways you can do it.
Spin-dependent lattice idea.
Okay, yes.
So that's another power presence.
Except now with the spin mixture, it's not really a spin-dependent lattice.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. But I also wouldn't call that far off resonance, because when you do this, immediately the issue experimentalists will tell you about is that there's a lot of scattering.
Well, you have to go between the fine structure states. So, I mean, there's a lot of space, but it's maybe not, you know, very far off resonance. So I would still call it far, but not very far.
It depends on the species in the end. In the end, it depends on the species. And so, okay, so there are two alternative approaches, one of which Peter just brings up. If you look at the energy shift versus laser wavelength, here I'm showing you rubidium. There's two resonances that are quite close. We'll call these a D1 and D2 resonance. And halfway in between them, there's a zero crossing in the shift. And so if you tune a laser to this frequency, and then you've got potassium around, that laser will only manipulate potassium. Or if you have two other species around, it will only manipulate those other species. And it won't do anything to rubidium because it has exactly zero shift. Okay. A simpler way to do it would be just to tune close to one of these resonances so you have a really strong effect on rubidium, say, and by comparison, if you can then just turn down your laser power, there's very little effect for the other species. So these are two very simple ideas. And realize that one of these is zeroing the effect on the atom I'm drawing the resonance structure for, and the other is maximizing it. So we call these tune in and tune out. Okay, here you're tuning in your effect on rubidium, here you're tuning it out. Now the problem when you get close to the resonances, not hundreds of nanometers away like typical far-off resonance traps, but maybe just 5 nanometers away, is that you also have heating. So you have a dipole potential and you have heating. And we can calculate these just by second-order perturbation theory, summing up all the shifts. And let me point out immediately that both the shift and the heating are proportional to intensity in a low saturation limit. Okay, so, yeah?
What was capital delta in the heating expression? Just curious.
Yeah, so this is the detuning from the excited to the ground state. So we're looking at the scattering you get from a small excited state fraction of a ground state, you sum up over all the possible excited states, and then this is the population, the excited state fraction, times the scattering rate.
It's not the same as little omega eg, or it's the entire difference.
So this is delta eg. This is equal to this in parentheses. Now, omega is the frequency. Delta is the detuning, so you've subtracted off the laser frequency. So it'd be zero if you're on resonance.
So delta is this entire difference, omega L minus omega G?
Yes.
Can I ask, how stable for the particle, the rubidium atom, being on the near resonance of the positive scattering at that time?
Well, the question is how stable it is. Well, your laser will not shift its detuning due to anything rubidium does. So I'm not drawing a spatial potential there. I'm not drawing a spatial potential. I'm drawing something versus frequency. Maybe I didn't understand the question.
In the fermion system, if in the positive scattering length side, usually you have like a molecule in the inside. The scattering, the state of the scattering wave can decay to a molecule side. I'm not sure for the bosonic system here. But for fermion system, for the positive scattering side, usually there's a molecule instead of.
Okay, I should probably explain the axes of this. This is an energy shift versus a wavelength of the laser.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Did that answer your question? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so now we want to optimize these things. They're two fairly straightforward alternatives, but still the question is which one is best and how do we choose our parameters? And so there are two criteria we want. I'm going to label the thing we want to trap or want to affect the target and the thing we want to do nothing to the spectator. And so first of all, you want this to be selective. So you want the ratio of the induced potential to the of the target to the spectator to be high. And the second is that you want heating to be low. And so here's a quantity I'm going to call sustainability, which has units of time, and that's the potential shift on the target divided by the heating rate to each one. The heating rate is energy per time, the shift is energy, and so this is going to be something in units of time. And the question is, what scheme maximizes both the selectivity and the sustainability of an atom in this trap? And so you can go through and look for these wavelengths, which I call tune-out wavelengths. They're also the same wavelengths that will give you a spin-dependent lattice, although we're considering only the potential which would have no, only the state which would have feel no potential for each of these atoms. And so for rubidium, the one I just showed you is that somewhere around 790, you get a crossover with zero shift. And you can find out what these wavelengths are for other species. And what I want to draw your attention to is this heating rate, okay, this scattering rate column. This is the scattering rate divided by the intensity. And, well, is this far detuned or not? You can see that the scattering cross-section changes by six orders of magnitude between cesium and lithium. And that's simply because the fine structure splitting changes tremendously from one to the other. Okay, so it looks like this is a scheme that's going to work well for the more massive elements with larger fine structure, and for lithium, which has something like a 10 gigahertz fine structure splitting, there's going to be a lot of heating. Let me also point out, though, even though there's a heating rate that's high, the selectivity in this scheme is infinite in the sense that the ratio of target to spectator is infinite. So now to evaluate these sustainabilities, which have units of seconds, you need to choose what mixture you have and then figure out what they are. So the rows here are, for the top row in each of these elements, the tune-out scheme, and for these, a given selectivity in the tune-in scheme. And I'm using targets, which are fermions, and spectators, which are bosons, although you can calculate this for any mixture.
Why are you not able to tune between, say, two principal quantum numbers for the zero? You don't really have to go, I think, between the fine structure. I mean, this gives you the spin-dependent lattice, but if you have independent species, you know, if I have a single channel that gives me, so to say, my AC Stark shift, I will get an exact zero between the principal values, and then I have a huge detuning. So are you, this would only mean that in one case you might have a blue, you know, a blue laser light, and so if you want to make a bar of resonance trap, it's not what you want to do. If you want to do a lattice, I think it would be a very good answer.
Yeah, I think you're right that detuning will also have a zero. And I think that the issue is what the selectivity can be. Because the ratio of the detuning...
Yeah, I'm only saying that your scattering rate that you were, of course, complaining about in the previous slide would be essentially zero.
Yes. I think you're right. We should look into that. Yeah, that's a good idea. Okay, so let me point out that a couple of these mixtures have very promising numbers, that if you have a mixture, for instance, of cesium and potassium-40 in this tune-out scheme, if you tune between the hyperfine splitting of cesium, you have something like 26 seconds sustainability. And since experiments in lattices can last as short as milliseconds, this really means that the heating rate is quite low already for this kind of scheme. Another combination which looks very nice is for the tune-in scheme is sodium-potassium with a 53-second sustainability if you have a ratio of potential which is 10 to 1. One thing that's kind of striking after picking out these two numbers is almost no groups work with these two combinations. But we didn't bias our search to only what people were working with. So what the species we're working with is potassium-40 and rubidium-87, and there you can see that these are comparable. Maybe the tune out scheme is slightly better. So however you do that, you might start to think about the interesting situation of having a lattice for one species and not for another. And let me talk about two applications. One of them is effective mass tuning. The idea being if you look at a delocalized matter wave, if you look at a block wave and you look at the effective mass that it will have, as you increase the lattice depth, you'll change the ratio of the effective mass to the bare mass. You'll change the curvature of in the band structure. Okay. And so what I want to draw your attention to is, let's say we take lithium and cesium. Lithium is a lot lighter than cesium. And so if I plot the ratio of their effective masses versus lattice depth, I can either increase or decrease that ratio. And whether I increase or decrease it depends on the selectivity of the species' selective lattice. So there's a factor in this equation, which is 1 minus square root of their mass ratio divided by the selectivity. So if the selectivity is greater than 133 over 6, then as you turn up the lattice, lithium gets relatively heavier. And the selectivity is less than that, if you turn up the lattice, lithium gets lighter. So with a very high selectivity and a high lattice depth, you can cross 1, which is about here. In other words, you can make lithium look heavier than cesium. So another strange thing that came up when we considered the interaction effect on the selectivity of these two lattices. Because you're trapping their target in a lattice, your spectator may see a kind of mean field due to this target. And if you just look at, say, unity filling, it's a lattice created in the spectator by the interaction between the two atoms, even though there is no optical lattice felt on the spectator. And so in a way, that's kind of neat, because you create a non-sinusoidal and possibly dynamic lattice that the spectator will move around in. Everywhere there's population of the target, you'll see there'll be a well. Now, one caveat is taking a mean field picture down to an occupation that could be unity per site might not be valid. So interested to hear comments of theorists on that. And the flip side of this is you can't get a very selective lattice if you have two species which are interacting, because once you create a lattice for one of them, the other one's going to feel a lattice through the interaction between the two atoms. So
what is actually your requirement for these scattering lengths that you must have? I mean, it is essentially the attractive interaction between the one which is creating this lattice here, the second one for the spectator. Is this what you're saying here?
Yeah, so this is the maximum selectivity you could get given a scattering length between the two species. So if I tell you a selectivity I want, if you tell me a selectivity you want, I can tell you what scattering length you'd have to have between the two atoms.
Okay, but is your hope that you would actually get a bound state then in this little lattice you're drawing here? Or?
I haven't looked into bound states, no.
That's a here.
So you would like to
have.
You could, yeah.
So you would like to have a Hubbard model, but I mean, if I have unit filling up there, like if a mod insulator for your green ones, for example, I mean, the blue ones essentially would see the same kind of lattice, so what will I eventually gain? I would make sort of a different kind of a lattice, but it would have the same lattice spacing. So
that's right. I don't know. My question is that interesting? Is there something interesting about that?
So you're saying that if there's a random occupation of your green ones, then the other ones would also see a random occupation.
Right, right. It could be a lattice with sites missing.
Yeah. But is it very important for the spectator to switch off its optical lattice, because you know if it sort of sees the green ones, then you know it still sees an optical lattice, will simply be a Hubbard model, you know, with random offset interaction at the points where it's good, is it?
Yeah.
So is it essential for me to switch off the?
Maybe not that it's zero, but that this is a dominant effect, I think. I suppose it depends what physics you're looking at.
So actually there are a couple of things one could actually envision doing with this type of stuff. And one of them is, for example, this interaction. We could use this type of effect to create no local interactions, for example, in the lattice, right? So you could use, you have, let's say, your spectator, let's say, is a condensate, for example, right? And then if you put
what about polarons now? Or?
Well, some like polaron type, type effects, right? So basically, if the upper one, it's like a matrix effect. If the upper one would make a hole, right? This hole would generally be the size of the hole would generally be kind of like a healing length, which can be substantial.
So for mediated interactions, the healing length tells you something like the range of these mediated effects. And there the advantage of having less confinement for the spectator is that you decrease the density and you might be able to enhance these, to increase the healing length so that they might actually reach several lattice sites.
There are a couple of really kind of interesting possibilities and they would work provided that this interaction is large and is strong enough. But the problem there is somehow, I think one has to really watch for like phase separation essentially, because there is, if you make this, it just often happens that if you make this interaction sufficiently strong that, you see some effects like the one that you show, this matrix type effect, I think sort of the systems like to phase separate. At least in many body, if you have really degenerate systems and stuff.
Okay, so that's pretty much all I wanted to say about that topic. It seems like there could be some interesting prospects for mediated interactions, as Misha was just saying. If an effective mass is an important parameter to the physics you want to look at, then you could engineer the ratio of effective masses. The lattices you can create might have a dynamic character. Certainly, they're non-sinusoidal. It might be also possible to use this in a cooling scheme where you compress one species in the presence of a bath spectator. And so basic experimental issues are that the heating rates, are they low enough? Some of the physics that's interesting may be at very low temperatures, in which case even these long sustainabilities aren't enough. And selectivity, if you really want a selective lattice, may be limited by these interactions. And finally, thermalization between two species can be slow in lattices. Okay, so let me switch gears now and talk more about stuff we're doing in the lab. I'm going to first talk about our setup, although I think a lot of this audience was at ICAP, or have heard me say some about this before. So I'm going to go through this in a kind of abbreviated way, but stop me if you have any questions. So our approach is to use a single vapor cell, mix rubidium 87 and potassium 40. We collect them in a traditional 6B MOT, and then we transport our collected atoms up to a microfabricated magnetic trap. And in this magnetic trap, we do our evaporation, we do most of our experiments, and then we drop the clouds and image them. So here's a picture of a MOT of rubidium atoms. This is about 10 to the 9 rubidium atoms. And this distance here is 5 centimeters. So you're looking into our vapor cell. And we turn off the light, trap the atoms, and move them up to here. Okay. What's nice about this system is it's very simple. There's no Zeeman slower. There's not multiple chambers, multiple loading. All we do is collect the atoms and put them onto this magnetic trap here. So the microfabricated chip has several different wires, and a couple of them will come back in a few minutes. But the primary wire we care about is in a Z shape, and above that we form a small magnetic trap. So because that trap is tightly confining, we can evaporate very quickly and very efficiently. So we see a Bose condensate with only a factor of 30 loss in atom number after loading the trap, versus a more typical factor of 1,000 in most experiments. And we can mix together potassium and rubidium in this trap and do sympathetic cooling. So here's a kind of artist's conception of what this looks like. This is, again, our chip, and here's this white-hot wire here sitting right below nanokelvin atoms. And in this mixture, we're evaporating away the rubidium, which cools the rubidium, and then it sympathetically cools this green here, which is potassium in this drawing. So you know when you get to Fermi degeneracy, when you look at the expansion energy, and you see that as you decrease the temperature, you no longer follow equipartition, but you diverge from that to some kind of finite energy at zero temperature, which is, of course, the Fermi energy. One interesting thing we saw along the way was that the mixture of rubidium and potassium was not as efficient at sympathetic cooling as we had anticipated. And at first, we thought, due to the zero temperature scattering length between these atoms, that potassium rubidium would always be well mixed with a higher cross-section than rubidium rubidium. And so the kind of naive estimate of this cross-section stays above rubidium's rethermalization. But in fact, there's a zero in the scattering called the Ramsauer-Townsend effect. And we were able to look at this cross-section versus time and observe that it dropped off quite a bit near the temperatures we were loading. Nonetheless, we're able to cool very quickly in about 6 seconds. And what's nice about that is we get a high data rate. So in any kind of experiment where you want statistics, where you want to do an experiment many times, this high data rate is nice. We can sympathetically cool in a few seconds. And again, to compare that to cycle times in the field as high as, say, 5 minutes. There are several tools that chip traps, microfabricated traps, bring online. One line of investigation pursued, for instance, in the Vuletich and Reichow labs is single atom detection, where you integrate optical detection onto a chip, and then you can see atoms as they're moving through cavities. One which we'll exploit is that you're very close to a number of wires, one of which can be used to send in radio frequency, so high-frequency oscillating magnetic fields, and that can allow you to make new kinds of adiabatic potentials. And finally, you can not only put traps on your chip, but also interferometers or waveguides or other kinds of devices. So now let me talk a little bit about how we make a double well. The way we make a double well is using RF dressed fields. So if you imagine a spin 1/2 atom, the spin up state in a magnetic trap has a confining potential. And typically, we think of the RF fields around to do evaporation. You flip to another state, and then that state has a repulsive potential in the same magnetic field. But if instead you look at a dress state picture where you add the energy of the RF photon to this lower state, you promote the energy of this lower state to one that looks like this, where the energies here are degenerate at resonant RF coupling. And so now if you add some kind of coupling, some Rabi frequency, you make one state which has a double well in it. It has two minima. And another state which is a small trap with an edge. And so it's this lower state which is used for evaporative cooling. And since the experiments at Boulder in 1995, pretty much all groups make cold clouds using this state. And what's new about this work is we simply use the other state. Okay. It's kind of neat because it was a state that was sitting there all along in most experiments. It's just the ability to couple into it that comes with a high RF amplitude. And so in particular, the people that showed this makes a nice double well was the Schmiedmeyer group in a paper published in 2005 in Nature Physics. The first author, a PhD student at the time, was Torsten Schum. He came to my lab as a postdoc thereafter, and he likes double wells so much, he said, well, why don't we just make one here too? And we kind of set up a frequency chain and got us going on this. But really, that's initial work done in Heidelberg at the time. So the way this works, The reason there's a double well instead of just a shell of resonance at a certain magnetic field is because there's a polarization effect as well. The effective potential is given by the difference between the RF photon and the magnetic trap plus a term which is proportional to the perpendicular oscillating field, because it needs to couple two different MF states. And so if you have an oscillating field in the left-right direction, and then I plot the vector direction of a quadrupole field near the center, you can see that the minimum coupling comes along these directions, where the local magnetic field is more parallel with the RF field. So because of that, on this shell of resonance here, that also extends out of the board, there's a minimum here due to a minimum Rabi frequency on two lines, like this. And that's what we're doing when we're creating this double well. We're taking a single well at the middle, and we're splitting it into two lines and then pulling them apart. So the geometry in the Heidelberg experiment, which we've reproduced, is that you have your trapping wire, and then you make a double well potential directly underneath an RF wire. And this RF wire is providing this local perpendicular polarized RF field. And then at that place, when you change the frequency or change the amplitude, you can tune the distance between these two double wells. Does that geometry make sense? Any questions about that? Okay. All right, so you can make a couple of different types of measurement. One thing you can do is you can make these wells far enough apart that you can optically resolve two different wells. And if you do that, then you can actually count the number in the left versus the right well. Okay. You can also not pull them that far apart, just pull them a little bit apart, and then let them drop and interfere, and you do a double slit kind of experiment where you make an interference pattern. So this has a kind of sinusoidal component, and the phase of this interference pattern tells you about the relative phase of the two wells. So it's nice because we can, with different parameters, either measure the relative number, the number difference, or the relative phase. And let me also point out that since we have bosons and fermions on our chip, we can make double well potentials for either species, although for the rest of what I'm going to tell you about, we've only been working with rubidium 87. Now, one other kind of funny thing is that this is actually a species-specific potential. And so here I'm showing you a picture of pulling rubidium apart in a kind of unbalanced double well. And potassium is just left behind in the middle. Okay, so if I add these two images together, you can see that potassium is just sits here while rubidium is pulled apart. And so that's kind of neat. There's a species-dependent potential we're creating. The basic reason is that the resonance in rubidium is between two magnetic states. They're separated by the Bohr magneton times this GF factor, which is a half in rubidium, and it's 2/9 in potassium. And so because the difference between the different magnetic quantum number states are off by this ratio of 4/9, you have a completely separate resonance for potassium and rubidium. You could extend this to any species you want, even that have the same GF, if you make this coupling across the hyperfine splitting in the ground state. So in general, you can make species-dependent manipulations. Okay, so now here's towards a direct observation of number squeezing, and this is work in progress I'm going to try to explain to you. What do we want to do with these double wells is look at the Josephson effect. And this is an effect that's been observed in superconductors, of course, and that's what Josephson originally predicted or explained. Which was it, predicted or explained?
Predicted.
Okay. And then I think Anderson predicted that you should see a kind of super leak, also the same thing in liquid helium, and this was observed. In cold gases, the Josephson effect was started to be discussed and observed actually by Kasevich in 98 and Obertaller in 2005. Kasevich has worked with a standing wave, so a kind of array of junctions, whereas Obertaller works with just a single double well. There's also what Leggett calls the internal effect, where instead of actually pulling two things apart and connecting them spatially, or having two different wells, you just have two internal states, and similar physics occurs. And an analog to what's been seen in superfluid helium-3 was seen in the Cornell-Wyman labs in 1998. So a simple model for this double well is this Josephson Hamiltonian, which has a charging energy and a Josephson energy, a tunneling strength. And the charging energy is quadratic in the number difference, which is what I'm calling M here. And the tunneling energy is quadratic in the phase. Okay. So what we need to do is figure out what these parameters are for our system. And here I'm showing some field plots of these double wells. So this is in microns. If we have a 10 micron splitting between the two wells, you can see that there are two minima and a barrier. Something that's kind of interesting is that the barrier is actually smaller around the edges. So I don't know if that makes a kind of interesting connection. And then along one direction, because this is a very elongated trap, these two scales are the same. Along the other direction, the elongated direction, this is hundreds of microns. And that makes the junction area something like 5 by 100 microns. And the wells, we can start at zero and pull them about 200 microns apart. The atom number, the total atom number we're working with, is about 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 4.
Why are you expanding the cosine and the harmonic approximation from the very beginning?
Because I'm just writing up the simplest Hamiltonian, and this is only valid for small theta, yeah, small phi.
Which is experimentally realized.
Yes. So there are several regimes of coupling energy to Josephson energy, or interaction to tunneling strength. One of them is where the interaction strength is very weak, which is the Robbie regime. One of them is where they're very strong, and that's the Fock regime. And in between is this interesting Josephson regime, and that's where this ratio U over J goes from 1 over N squared to 1. So this is immediately reminiscent to, at least in this community, to the superfluid to Mott transition, where you start with a very small on-site interaction in a lattice, and you move to a very strong on-site interaction. Except in that regime, we're in the physics that I guess we'll hear about this afternoon from Emmanuel, the number is comparable to 1. So this whole regime where U over J is between 1 and 1 over N squared, and you see a different behavior, doesn't exist in that system for low and commensurate fillings.
But your Hamiltonian that you wrote would not cover.
Yes, I that's a very good point. So the Hamiltonian I wrote is really only valid in the Josephson regime. Yeah.
Your J itself is proportional to N. J is not a 1.5.
Yes, you're right. You're right. J is roughly proportional to N. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So our parameter regime is something like U over J is about 10 to the minus 5. 1 over N squared is about 10 to the minus 7 or so. And so we're clearly in this Josephson regime. But as I'll discuss, what's interesting is we can tune from near the Robbie regime towards the Fock regime. So the classical oscillation frequency in a Josephson junction is given by the square root of the ratio of U times J, and that just means that you have levels that have a level spacing of H bar omega J. The ground state at an expectation value of 0 for the number difference and the phase difference has a width which is j over u to the 1/4 power. And so the basic idea of these experiments is that you tune j by increasing the splitting, and then you look at the quantum fluctuations in the ground state by looking at the width and the number difference. Okay, so here's a plot of tuning. A couple of things kind of mushed together. What I'm tuning here is the amplitude of the RF potential. And as I tune that amplitude, the barrier, which is this line here, starts out at 0 and comes up to hit and then surpass the chemical potential. And so right at this point here, we start to have splitting. Okay. Now, if I just look at the location of the minimum and the potential and look at the splitting starts at 0 and then moves up to about 4 microns at this position here. Okay. So we have the single well, we're pulling them apart, and then at some separation, the barrier height pushes through the chemical potential, and you start having a two-mode system. So let me zoom in to this and plot the interesting quantity, which is this Josephson energy in Hertz. It starts at about 30 or so and decreases as we increase the amplitude. So this is a very narrow range just above splitting where this quantity decreases. And the x's I'm showing here are an exponential fit, so a simple exponential. And you can see that omega j decreases by 1 over e about every 15 milligauss. So just after we push through this barrier height, we can start decreasing omega j. And the order of magnitude numbers for charging energy and Josephson energy is 0.1 hertz and 5 kilohertz. So what we would see as we move through this splitting regime is that for a little while, there would be an adiabatic evolution. And as you have this adiabatic evolution continuing, the ground state will continue to narrow in its number difference. And then at some point, you'll be moving too quickly because the tunneling energy will just be decreasing exponentially as you pull the two wells apart. And at that point, you can think of it as freezing the number distribution. Okay, so this is an argument explained to me by Eugene Dimler, but who attributes this, in a sense, to Tony Leggett, who kind of sketched this out in a PRL comment on somebody else's paper in 1998. So it's kind of an obscure literature history. And the basic idea is that if we say we're adiabatic when omega j dot is less than omega j squared, then we freeze when omega j dot is about equal to omega j squared. And if you just say that one of these is simply decreasing with time, and that's supported by the calculation I just showed you, then you would get that the spread in number would decrease with 1 over square root of time as you're pulling these wells apart. So there's been some very strong evidence that this is what's happening. And this is a paper by Wolfgang Ketterle's group where they look at the width of the phase distributions at various hold times. So they pull these wells apart, and they don't pull them far apart and count the number, like we're thinking of doing, but they pull them just a little bit apart until they're well separated enough, but still close enough to make an interference pattern. And then they look at the phase. And every time you do that, you make an interference pattern, you get some phase. But how well determined that phase is can only be assessed by doing an average over many repeated tries. This is related to what Almut was saying yesterday. And so you run that same hold time, the same experiment many times, and you look at the distribution, and what they plot here is a quantity they called randomness. The idea being, if it were completely random, you would have some kind of equal distribution of all phases, but it's not random. And in fact, this non-randomness survives in their trap for several hundred milliseconds. So why is this evidence of squeezing? They calculate that this blue dashed line is what you would have expected for a coherent state preparation of the two wells. Instead, they observe something that's fit with this black line here and consistent with an initial number that's squeezed by a factor of 10 below what you'd expect for a coherent state, below square root of n. So the picture, it's something like doing a time of flight image, except the initial number spread leads to a winding up the phase, and after you wind up the phase, you can see what that initial number distribution was. There's also some related work by Kasvich last year and this year. So what we'd like to do is to do a direct measurement of the squeezing. And the measurements of these coupled BEC systems have been exclusively on the phase so far, but that's somewhat complicated by the fact that these condensates are elongated, that there's other mechanisms of phase diffusion, and you could suspect something like a weak link between the two condensates. Whereas none of these are complications if you just pull the atoms apart and you image directly. So in order to do that, we would need to develop sub-shot noise number measurements on each side to be able to measure the number in each well better than square root of n. And that's in progress. We're pretty much at the shot noise limit right now. So status is work in progress. Let me also say that one thing that's very appealing to us to counting the number is that we can apply these methods to fermions. So even if you pull apart fermions and you don't expect there to be a definite phase, you can still count the number and see if there is comparable effects due to Fermi statistics. Okay, so how am I doing on time? Okay, so a few other things are in progress in our lab, and I only have a slide on each of these. One of these is that we're loading potassium 40 into a cross-dipole trap, and we'd like to go to the Feshbach resonance and look at an interesting proposal by McDonald and coworkers, where they suspect that some of the signatures seen to date due to interaction energies were zero because of what they call itinerant magnetism, a coherence in the spin that's enforced by the strong interactions in the atoms. So this data is from Christoph Solomon's lab. So for lithium, the particle lifetime is, I think, tens of seconds. And for potassium, it's only up to a second, maybe a tenth to 1 second. So the lifetime is always higher on the negative scattering length side. Is that right? Yeah. I have to.
Positive side, you approach resonance, the three body bumps increase very quickly. Yes.
Okay, I could listen to Faye. Yeah, I'm. Okay. In the same optical trap for potassium 40, we're interested in following up a proposal of Peter's from many years ago now. To look at light scattering off of fermions. And one thing that we've developed is some semi-classical numerics that will allow us to calculate these effects in our traps without any constraints in symmetry, because to date, people have done a lot of numerical calculations of this effect. The basic effect we're looking for is that if you scatter light and you're scattering ideal fermions, the momentum recoiled fermions need to be able to find a place to go in the trap. And if many of the states are already occupied, then those are blocked. So in a sense, it's like looking at spontaneous emission or scattering in a cavity where you've affected the available density of states of the final modes, except instead of blocking some of the photon modes, you're blocking some of the atomic modes. So running through the numbers, it looks like you can't just look at this effect by light scattering and measuring the absorption. And we can talk about why optical density prevents you from doing that. What we like to do is use internal state tagging and look at an optical pumping signature to see this effect. And in order to do that, you need to be in an optical trap. Another nice thing about a crossed optical dipole trap is we think we can get a ratio of the recoil energy to the Fermi energy, or sorry, the reverse ratio, this should be EF over ER, of about 4. Okay, so that's what I want to tell you about this morning. I've told you a little bit about species selective environments, both ideas for optical lattices and an observation using RF dress potentials. I told you about the fact that we have a DFG on a microfabricated trap and what might be fun about that. We have some double well potentials, and we're starting to look at the fluctuation statistics and work starting up, and in the near future will become more of our focus is optically trapped fermions. Thank you very much.
Any more questions?
Why don't you see the idea about the itinerant magnetism? Can we turn to that page?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. There isn't really much on this page. Let me try to explain what the idea is. That if you have a coherent superposition of spin up and spin down, and then you go to a Feshbach resonance, there's still no interaction energy. Okay. You need a mixture, an incoherent mixture, to have an interaction energy. And so experimentalists have observed, I think the most dramatic story I hear is from Randy Hewlett, that you try to make a mixture, and so you make a pi pulse, you make a coherent superposition, you kind of assume things will decohere quickly, because they always do, decoherence is always our worst enemy, etc. He does this, and the atoms don't decohere. They wait around, there's no decoherence. And in order to get a mixture, they apply a gradient, they apply a strong gradient in their trap, and then they make like 100 pi over 2 pulses or something like this. They just kind of scramble their RF field, and they have to really force the atoms to decohere. Yeah. And so there might be some interesting physics behind that. I mean, most labs have just kind of steamrolled this problem, found a way to make an incoherent mixture, and then studied the interesting BC-BCS crossover physics in a mixture. But what we'd like to do is come back to that preparation issue and look at the coherence times of a superposition at various interaction strengths. And what's interesting about that is some of the argument in this paper really is just that a ferromagnetic state has the same energetics. In a ferromagnetic state, you think about, instead of just thinking about superposition of up and down, maybe I just say that all the atoms are an X now instead of Z, right? And then they're aligned. And the problem is that that's the ground state. And I think itinerant, this word here, if I'm understanding condensed matter language correctly, means that you can spontaneously form this state. It can relax to that state. Okay, you know more about this than I do. Yeah, okay.
Passive intention to satisfy the Stoner criteria. The problem is that on this side, the scattering length goes to very positively large, and how stable the system is.
You can also control the density of the bottom level, you can change the boundary. The criteria is the U times the density of the bottom level.
Actually, so I'm a little bit confused. So is there a statement here that interaction prevents system from decohering?
Yes.
Okay. So even, let's say, in the presence of small gradients and so on?
Yes, yes. Even in the presence of gradients, yes.
So basically, they sort of force, for example, from ferromagnetic, I think it's very clear what would happen, right? It just forces spins to be aligned, so, you know, it's energetically very costly. Right.
Right. Right. I mean, one thing that's striking here is I think what may be confusing is this is not the resonance here. The resonance is over here. You're approaching the strongly interacting regime, and in this data, instead of this continuing up, it's suddenly you see something here which is non-interacting. And more or less, I think you see this data in a couple of experimental results, and it's just a non-equilibrium phase is what basically is ascribed to. So we like the look of this non-equilibrium phase.
So what's the scantiness at 700 Gauss each
month? I don't know my lithium well enough to tell you. Maybe Kathy knows the scattering thing. But,
Because, I mean, just coming on that question, I think for sodium atoms, Wolfgang's group did experiment in 1998, and they can back up the scatterings up to, I think, 100 scatterings. And after that, the trap loss is very significant.
But I don't think you should look at sodium as an example. The losses case for sodium, for bosons and fermions is very different.
I know.
And so this 98 result was actually quite pessimistic in the sense, I mean, I don't know if the paper was pessimistic, but you look at the results and you think, gosh, we'll never be able to use this effect. So I don't think you want to look at those sodium results.
They have two order of magnitude in terms of scatterings.
Okay.
Before the whole thing becomes
okay.
Impossible. So even that's, in your case, it probably is the worst scenario you can already push to 100 times the best.
So even this trip would be very exciting. So we know this ferromagnetism. So this is the S-wave type. So it still can be realized in magnetic resonance system, for example, in iron, copper, nickel. But this iron magnetism is generally belong to a large class of instability of a surface called polarization instability. So the other type, for example, high partial wave channel, for example, P-wave, D-wave type, which is probably transmitter system is called difficult. But suppose they have two species. This one 6 have a P-wave fetch balance between two species. If the positive lens, scattering lens size, the system can maintain stable for a long time, it will provide a very good chance to study the P-wave type magnetism.
Hmm. Okay,
so
I don't.
It's very difficult for a durable lens system. And from other hand side of point of view, the itinerant magnetism. From a theoretical point of view, it's much more difficult to problem than the superfluidity. Because in the superconductor superfluidity, the quasi-particle has a gap. The physics transition is relatively easier to handle. But for the itinerant magnetism, we have an entire point surface, all this exciting phase transition, even now it's not very understood. So if the system can, on this side can be stabilized, it would be a very exciting result in my
opinion.
How do they measure practically the interaction? Is it using a time of flight, look at the velocity after the ballistic expansion?
In this experiment, yes. But another way to do it is RF spectroscopy. So you look at the relative shifts to a third state.
Offset.
If you look at the distance, the RF photon you need to make a transition to another state, if there's an interaction energy, you can see a shift in that spectrum.
Okay.
And so that spectroscopy has been done by many labs.
But not for this particular.
I believe this was an expansion measurement, but I believe so. Yeah.
So if there is no other question, let's take the speaker.
Thank you.